supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, almost everyone over a, quote, certain age has had the experience of walking down the street, we're minding our own business, and all of a sudden there's no sidewalk, and we find ourselves in free fall, without a roadmap to guide us through our turmoil, grief, and despair. Many use music, poetry, or the visual arts to help. Joseph Luzzi turned to Dante and the Divine Comedy as his touchstone. His memoir is In a Dark Wood, What Dante Taught Me About Grief, Healing, and the Mysteries of Love. Joseph Luzzi, thanks so much for being with us today on Voices.
Thank you very much for having me.
Later on, we're going to be joined by award-winning artist, local Philadelphia artist, Sarah Steele, who uses her watercolors also for the same thing. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. So, Joseph, your book begins on November 29th, 2007. But tell us about that day.
Well, as I write in the book, you know, it started out as a morning like any other. As you said in your intro, you know, you're just walking down the street and suddenly the sidewalk disappears. In my case, I left the house in the morning to teach a class at Bard College in upstate New York. And as I settled in to teach one of my classes in mid-morning, there was a security guard had showed up at my door. And I was joking with my students. I said, look, they're coming to arrest me. But the security guard wasn't laughing or smiling. And so I sensed something was up. And I edged out of the class. He said, are you Joseph Luzzi? I said, yes. And I edged out of the classroom and I saw the associate dean and vice president of the college literally tearing up the stairwell. And I thought, oh, God, something has happened. So I started running out the building and I heard a voice, you know, behind me. I saw a security van and I heard a voice saying, Joe, your wife's had a terrible accident. And in fact, my wife, Catherine Lynn Mester, that morning had a terrible car accident. And she was 8.5 months pregnant, and 45 minutes before she died, our daughter Isabel was born, rescued by an emergency cesarean. So almost instantaneously, I became a father and a widower. As I write in the book, I'd left the house at 8:30, and by noon, I was a father and a widower.
Let's back up a little bit to the days and months before that day. You were teaching Dante at Bard. What was Catherine doing, and what were your plans for the future?
Catherine and I had been married for about a year and a half. She had tried to make it in New York as an actor, and her career there didn't work out as she had hoped, as so many people who go to New York with that kind of dream, right? She was also a very talented singer and dancer, but her acting career never quite took off. So she had decided to go back to school, and she was taking classes at nearby SUNY New Paltz and also teaching Pilates. And really, more than professional dreams and goals, at that point, our focus was on building a family. You know, we were awaiting the birth of our first child. We were happily married and just really immersed in this anticipation of being parents and excited about that.
How long had you known her?
We were together for about 5 years total. So I had known, I met her a few years earlier. And right from the night we met, it was, you know, the classic love at first sight. We were inseparable right from the beginning. I met her at an art opening. I was living in Brooklyn and commuting to Bard, and it was her birthday, and we met, and that was that was it, as they say.
That in love, that passion, holding kind of emotion you describe, were you feeling it that day too, on November 29th?
Love changes, and I don't think it lessens. I think it changes shape. Meet someone the first time, it's desire, the thrill of something new, anticipation. We were building a life together, so that love was much stronger, in a way. That initial desire, there's something not superficial, but it's based on kind of raw attraction and other things that are going on. But by the time we'd been married and waiting our child, I would say that we had settled into a loving and fulfilling marriage that was more powerful than the initial spark, so to speak. Especially when you add, the anticipation of the family growing.
So that day.
Yeah.
That moment, that November day. Tell us about your internal life when the sidewalk is pulled out and you're in free fall. Tell us about your internal life in the next moments, hours, couple days. What was it like inside?
I think for me, I'm someone who's I've always been very driven, very, task oriented, and someone who tries to be on top of things. And yet, it was a shock, and it was something so catastrophic, so monumental, that it really sends your body into a kind of shock. I talk about it in my book. I call it the fog of grief, and I think it's Freud who talked about grief as a kind of illness that no one can see, right? You don't have symptoms. You're not like, you don't have a broken limb, or you don't manifest disease, and yet something is wrong. It's like an illness. And for that first full year afterwards, I remember being in kind of a shock, in a kind of feeling something so overwhelming that it also insulated me from some of the difficulty. And I describe it in my book as the electric air of grief.
So,
I
want to follow that up. About the isolation, the wordlessness of what you went through, of what we go through, how isolating it is. And, we look to find a voice, right? Will anyone ever understand our experience? Are we disconnected from the human race forever? I mean, that was my experience, and that's the experience of many who experience trauma. There are not quite any easy way to describe your internal experience. And I wonder if that's what Dante did for you. He gave you words. And I wonder if this book did that for you also.
Well, that's a really fascinating point and question you raised, because that's exactly what the experience this was like for me, in that I was very lucky. I had an incredibly large, loving, Italian family, great close friends, a wonderful work community, resources. I had everything that one could hope for to deal with something like this. And even still, it was an incredibly lonely and isolating experience. No one can really help you through to a certain point. You have to get through it yourself. And that was this kind of, looking back on this period of intense isolation, loneliness, I do think that Dante's voice, I like the use of that word voice. I heard it. I'd been studying him for, over 30 years. I've been teaching and writing about him for 20 years. I heard his voice with an immediacy and intimacy that I never heard before, because Dante himself had suffered that trauma, that unspeakable rupture. He was exiled from Florence when he was 36 and spent the last 20 years of his life wandering.
I want to explore that with you. Let me just take a second and reintroduce you. We're talking with Professor Joseph Luzzi, and he is writing about his trauma is not even the right word, experience of becoming a widower and a father in the same day. So we're talking about Dante, and I want to talk about exile, because that's what we're talking about, your experience of exile, and I think most anybody who's experienced trauma, certainly that was my experience, and that was almost as painful as the loss itself. But you were always fascinated with his story of exile, when he was sentenced to exile while he was on a diplomatic mission. Why? Why was he sentenced to exile? And what's this connection between his and yours?
Well, Dante was, you know, in his mid-30s, he had it all. He was from minor nobility. He was one of the leading politicians in Florence and also one of its leading poets. Very active in local politics. He had reached the highest elected office in Florence. He was one of the city's priors. And Florence had been in a terrible civil war for generations. And Dante's party was one that... It was the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, and Dante was a Guelph, and, you know, he was on a diplomatic mission to Rome, and he ran afoul of the Pope, and as the fortunes changed in Florence and Dante's party fell out of favor, the Pope made sure that Dante was detained in Rome and eventually sentenced to exile in absentia, and they said, you know, if you come back to the city, you'll be burned alive. So Dante was left Florence on a diplomatic mission and was informed while he was away that he would never return to Florence. And the first few years, he tried desperately to get back to Florence. But after a few years, he understood that he wasn't going to make it and that the exile was permanent. It's only then, when he accepted that his former life was over, that he was able to sit down and begin writing the Divine Comedy, which took up, you know, the last 15 years or so of his life. So why that appealed to me was I wasn't kicked out of a city like Dante was, but I felt exiled from what the life that I once had. There I was, happily married, waiting for a child, suddenly a widower with this child, struggling to raise it on my own. I needed so much help from my family. I needed to get my personal life back together. Everything looked the same. I had the same job, the same friends, etc., but everything was different. So I felt exiled from what had been my life. And that's the Dante that spoke to me, the Dante who had been displaced.
Well, and apropos of that, you know, you were walking in your neighborhood right after the funeral, you bumped into the college chaplain, and she said, "You are in hell."
Yes, those were her words. "You're in hell." And I, of course, thought of Dante and his journey to hell. And I just, you know, I had been spending so much time. In a way, Dante had already gotten to be a very personal author for me, where I felt I didn't want to write a scholarly book because I felt it was too much connected to lived experience. And I wanted to write something for general readers. I didn't know what that would be. Eventually, it became very clear to me that the story was how Dante's voice of courage and hope in the midst of the ultimate setback allowed him to rebuild a new life. And I thought, you know, we can never hope to do something as great as the Divine Comedy, but in our small way, we can emulate Dante's message of resilience and endurance, and
this business of going to hell.
Yeah,
I personally, as a clinician, I feel that's necessary for growth. I treat patients, and they've got this nightmare, this hell, inside their head, and you know, my recommendation often is, you know, to go to hell. You know, I mean, and they pay me big bucks for that. But you know, really, I mean, that's
well,
diminish.
I think maybe what you're saying, if I understand, is something that I certainly lived through, is that you have to inhabit your grief. You can't run from it. You know, you can't run. Some people turn to, you know, destructive behavior, whatever. I didn't do any of that. And I went through some difficult times. And when I look back on the things I did right, I certainly made mistakes, and my book talks about those mistakes. But the one thing I did was I didn't run away from hell. I lived in hell for a while. You have to go through it. It's, you know, it's the brutal reality. As I said, no one can help you. People can help you through it, but you have to go through it alone, and you have to live in, I call it the underworld, you know. Not hell, because no one was torturing me. No one, you know, it wasn't eternal fire and brimstone, but it was like the underworld that you read about in classical literature and in Homer, this place of memory, regrets, you know, endless nostalgia, this place of just a life lost that you just can never reclaim. And for me, the hard part was I accepted that my wife has died, but it took a long time to accept that the life that I had with her was also gone.
Yeah, I've got it. That word is such a confusing word, except, you know, it's the older I get, the less clear that word is, what that means. Is there a period after the word accept? I mean, I don't think so.
I think maybe for me it was almost a physical process, now that we're talking about it. You live in hell, you're immersed in the grief. At a certain point, the grief gave way to mourning, where you can rebuild your life. You know, the first year you're suffering, you're dealing with the aftermath, you're anesthetized, you're in that fog of grief. I think you said it earlier, the mourning period is more difficult because the fog of grief has worn away and you're back among the living, and you have to build your life back. And it's very difficult because, you know, even with the best of intentions, people have moved on and you're expected to move on and get your rebuild a life. And it's hard to get back to where you once were.
Well, while you're doing all this, there's somebody named Isabel.
Yes.
And that's that little one that was what was born that day. And how did you love her initially? Did you love her? Was it contaminated? I mean, I can't imagine.
Yeah, the word's not contaminated. I would say that I loved her, and you know, she was the miracle that happened. All this that kept me going. But that instinct, you know, those fatherly instincts, the kind of sacrificing someone's needs, making the child's need the center of your life. I know all those things now because I've been blessed to have I remarried and have a son now, was born 7 months ago, and I know what it means to put your life on hold and live through another person's, a little person's needs. With Isabel, I was in a state. I was not just a grieving husband. It had happened so quickly. It was so shocking that the rug had been pulled beneath me. While I was in that shock, I instinctively turned to my family. My book is about family. I have four sisters and a brother and a mom, and we're very close, and they kind of closed ranks around me, and especially my mom, who was approaching 80, who she had six other children, you know, 13 grandchildren. She heroically jumped in, and at an age when people are winding it down, retiring, you know, she became a full-time caregiver to Isabel as I dealt with my grief.
I remember you said in your book that your sister Margaret joked, just leave Isabel with us and pick her up when she's 16.
She wasn't kidding, and you know, I didn't do that, but I did rely on them, and you know, very, very much. Not just in the beginning, but then we created a structure for raising her. And I should say, one of the remarkable things is that my daughter was insulated from my own grief and sorrow. She had somehow, because of all the love my family gave to her, a happy infancy, and you know, it was a vibrant, flourishing kid now. But I think the difficulty for me in writing the book, you asked earlier, was writing the book, you know, I don't know if you used the word cathartic, but the difficulty in writing this book was not so much revisiting the pain of Catherine's death. Those memories were so at the front that they came pouring out. It wasn't so much recalling Dante's lessons for me, because I, you know, those were also at the front of my mind. The difficulty was admitting the mistakes that I had made as a father and sharing with the world or whoever happens to read my book, you know, some of the shortcomings and difficulties I had in becoming and making the transition from being Isabel's biological father to her dad in all senses of the word.
And you know, I think that's the most painful thing for all parents, and especially the unique position you're in. I'll tell you, when anybody asks me my regrets in life, it's about just that, you know, the mistakes I made with my children. And, you know, I could still well up with tears and feel great shame about it. And, you know, in this case, it was 30 years ago, and it's still there with us. So what you've done is quite courageous. Joe, I've got to take a short break. There's so much more I want to talk to you about, including purgatory and that aforementioned woman that that you're currently married to.
Thank you very much.
If we're just tuning in, we've been talking with Joseph Luzzi. He's the author of In a Dark Wood. And it's a wonderful, important book about grief and recovery. Later on, we're going to be hearing from Sarah Steele, an award-winning artist here in Philadelphia. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Yampolsky Law PC, a law firm based in Tree Rose, Pennsylvania, focused on transforming conflict through mindful practices of collaborative law, mediation, family law, and labor and employment law. More information at conflicttransformed.com.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
For 3 decades, Dr. Dan Gottlieb has hosted thoughtful discussions on behavioral health on WHYY. Celebrate 30 years of Voices in the Family at a special event with Dr. Dan and friends at WHYY, Tuesday, September 8th. More at whyy.org/events.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking with Joseph Luzzi about his book and his life. His book is In a Dark Wood. So I want to follow up, Joseph. You know, your second section of your book, Tracking Dante's Divine Comedy, is about purgatory. And it opens up with you describing yourself 1 year after Catherine's death, lying naked in bed with a woman who sent you a condolence card you kept in a special place in your desk. You didn't even tell your therapist about this. How come?
Now you're making me blush, Dan.
Oh. I just want you to know I wasn't picturing you laying naked.
Okay.
But I can't vouch for all the people listening.
I would say that I didn't. I felt still married to Catherine. You know, it was. We were. I still wore my wedding ring for a full year after she died, and I knew, of course, at a certain point that I was going to start dating again, that I wanted to rebuild my personal life. You know, I waited until it was someone that I thought was someone that, you know, I cared about and could feasibly build something with. That relationship didn't work out, even though on paper there were a lot of things that drew us together, similar professional interest, and that she was also a literature, a PhD. She had experienced sudden death as well, and she was raising a daughter on her own. So there was a lot of symmetry there, to say the least. But we were at different stages, and I think, as I talked about in the book, the main thing was I was really looking for someone else to complete us. I could have started and built a family with just Isabel and me and struck out on our own, but I was with my family, and I were raising her together. I was really hoping that someone else would come into the picture, and that, you know, I would rebuild a family with Isabel and with someone else. It was too soon for that, as my grief counselor said, too soon. You know, this is early on in the game. And I had an incredibly helpful and caring grief counselor. But there were things that were difficult for me to discuss because of the complicated feelings of, you know, loss and that kind of irrational guilt that sure. so many people feel when you lose someone close, the closest person to you, right?
I was struck by a word you used. You know, after it had been well after she had died, you used the word in love. We usually say love. I still love her. But in love, that's quite different, and that's quite connected.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, you know, if that was part of what was going on when you were, you know, in bed, when, you know,
I think
you were still,
you know,
in love.
I think that's one of the ticks you have as a writer, especially a story like this that, you know, I edited so thoroughly and intensely over and over, is you get to the right word, and the right word was in love. That is different than loving someone. I think that in a way I was still, even though Catherine and my relationship had ended and our marriage had ended with her death, that emotionally I was not ready to open my heart to someone else. And I stubbornly plowed ahead at all costs, as I am unfortunately prone to doing. But, you know, my heart was what my head was trying to do, my heart would have none of it, because my heart still was attached to Catherine and the life that we had, and that I had to go through a period of really patiently waiting and letting go of that. And I think, you know, the woman that I was with had a better understanding of that takes a long time after death before you can really commit to someone else.
You know, when Dante lost his beloved Beatrice, he wondered about the very nature of love and if we can deeply love another person again. He learned that true love, if this is my understanding, the kind that outlives the mortal body, is fueled by faith and joy. And the only way to get to this is to let go of one's former life, one's former identity. That's a lot to ask.
It's a lot to ask. And I should also say, Dan, this is an important point, is Dante is not one of us. You know, he's writing in the 30s, writing in the early 1300s, and he was very Christian, and, you know, by the book, by the Bible. Mm-hmm. And for him, his relationship with Beatrice is not a kind of about a modern love, which is not just the soul but also the body and companionship, soulmate, and all in that sense of the word, some of the things that we look for in our partners. So Dante helped me with a lot of things, but his relationship with Beatrice, who was kind of a spiritual muse to him, did not help me, was not the guide to rebuilding love in my life. He gave me other things, but that part of my life was really, as I tell people when I do readings, a great book like Dante, you know, a guide like Dante is an incredible gift. But at the end of the day, even more than a book, it has to be a person that helps you through out of the dark wood. And so, you know, I didn't want to make Dante into a kind of easy self-help guide where he solved all my problems, you know, because he did help with a lot of them. But there were certain things that I was, you know, if not on my own, at least among the world of flesh and blood more than literature.
Listen, Professor Luzzi.
Yeah.
There's not much about Dante that is easy. He's a complicated dude, and for us regular people, his writing was complicated, too. You know, we need somebody like you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Dante is hard, but, you know, I think he's worth the effort. I get the feeling some people are intimidated when they see the word Dante in the title. The book is written for people with absolutely no previous knowledge of them. It's not written as an academic at all. It's very much, you know, for the general reader. And I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier in the show is, you know, some people turn to music, some people turn to poetry, to pictures. I just think these powerful stories by great writers, it's that miracle of literature. Why does it make sense to us? He wrote it in a different world, in a different context, you know, in 1305 to 1321. That's an extraordinary amount of time and distance, and yet it speaks to us today. It does take some work, and I think, you know, whether it's my students in the classroom or readers today, I would say it's worth the work. You know, it might not be as easy as a contemporary guide or, you know, a self-help book, but there's a kind of lasting wisdom in there that is worth the journey.
Joseph, tell us about this woman that helped you out of purgatory.
Well, I had gotten to the point where there was a new life after Catherine's death, in the sense that I was raising Isabel with my family. I was dividing my time between Bard and my family's home in Rhode Island, leading this split life, and kind of stuck in gear. And that became purgatory, where it was no longer grief, but it was mourning. And I was still working my way out of Catherine's death. And I had been dating, and yet it just seemed, I wasn't giving up hope, but it got to the point where I thought, my gosh, my situation is so complicated. Here I am. I have, you know, a infant girl is almost about 3 years old. My family is completely co-parenting with me. I teach in a beautiful but rural area that's, you know, far from a lot of cities where people congregate in critical masses. And yet I want to meet someone and complete, you know, rebuild my personal life as well. And then I always tell people, I don't know, you probably agree, the best things in life are chance and unexpected.
As are the worst things. So go on.
Unexpectedly, this wonderful woman, Helena Bailey, who's a artist in residence, a musician, my first exposure to her was she did this beautiful Bach concert playing Bach. And she came into our lives, and we met, and she was the first person, and there were, you know, I had met some very incredibly generous-minded and helpful women as I had been dating, but I think Helena was where I felt she is going to embrace this in all its complexity. You know, the widower, the grieving husband who's now past grief and into mourning, the infant girl, and it just felt right away. And
how long have you been together?
We met in 2011. We were married in 2012, and our son James was born this past January. So,
and
Isabel is a great big sister, I should add.
And Isabel is what, about 8 years old now?
Yeah, she's about 7 and a half, pushing 8.
Yeah. Yeah, that's terrific. We're going to take another short break. When we come back, I want to introduce you and our listeners to Sarah Steele. Like I mentioned, she's an award-winning artist and a community activist here in Philadelphia. We've been talking with Joseph Luzzi. He's the author of In a Dark Wood. He's also written My Two Italies, and he's a professor of comparative Italian literature at Bard College. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has worked to provide loving and clinical care to some of the most vulnerable members of society, including individuals on the autism spectrum. Austin, who first attended a Devereaux school at age 5, was almost entirely unable to communicate. Through a combination of his mother's advocacy, his hard work, and the support of Devereaux, he said, "I love you," to his mother for the first time. More about Devereaux's programs and services online at devereaux.org.
I'm Robin Young. The new movie based on Bill Bryson's attempt to hike the Appalachian Trail comes out this week. We'll speak with a man who finished the hike more than a dozen times.
It's very simple. You know, we're made and we're built to walk. Just walking a long way is open to a lot of people, and I like that.
Next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We've been talking with Joseph Luzzi, and we will continue to do so. But now we have Sarah Steele joining us by telephone, as promised. And like I said, she's an award-winning artist, community activist, and a friend of mine for, I don't even want to know how long. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Dan.
Welcome.
I think it's 30 years.
Well, apropos of that, we met at Friends Hospital, which is a psychiatric hospital here in Northeast Philadelphia. And I was giving a talk, and you had your art on display.
Yes.
So give us some background. Why was your art on display at Friends Hospital?
My art was on display because a collector of mine was running the hospital at that time, and he knew what I had been involved with for the prior 5 or 6 years. I was at one of those points in my life where I hit a dead end, and I didn't know what to do. And I got into therapy with a very wise woman. And as we got into some of the deeper experiences that, you know, really were illustrating that I had post-traumatic stress disorder, she advised me to go in my studio and make paintings, and then we would talk about them. And it just opened up worlds to me. I was, like Joe said, I was lonely and isolated and didn't know what to do. And through that, I just really, you know, processed a lot of that work. And then started coming out and exhibiting it, which was terrifying at first. And this collector saw my exhibit, my first exhibit, and knew that I was working in the community. At that point, I was working with battered women to do similar things. And he invited me to do that exhibit.
Let me understand the specifics here, Sarah. You did your art, and it was helpful. And you mm-hmm. used the word processed, but I let's assume I don't know what that means. What was it about art and making art that was healing for you?
For me, being in my studio is healing in several ways. One is when I can get into a place where I am deeply experiencing an emotion, not in my head, in my body, and allowing that to come through my hand onto paper, it sort of comes out without me knowing what's happening. And then when I look at it afterwards, I start learning from it. And that process of learning from it can go on for many years. In that case, I was also taking those paintings to my therapy sessions, and we were looking at those things together and making sense of them, and making sense of my experience through that.
It's interesting that what you do is beyond words, and Joseph what helped you was all about words. And you know, there's something about the arts, and that's what you said when we spoke to you. You wanted this book to be about, is to underscore what the arts can do to help us overcome our grief, no matter what it is.
Well, if I may, can I jump in?
Yeah.
I love, it's what Sarah, am I hearing that correctly? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What Sarah said is the sense that inhabiting an emotion physically and then making something of it. What we talked about earlier is how isolating grief can be and how internal. And I think for me, whether it's a verbal art or nonverbal art, what the arts do is take you out of yourself and put you in another space where you can empathize with other people, where you can, you know, whether it's hearing Dante's voice or feeling someone else's pain, I think it opens you up to that kind of connective space that trauma and grief work against by creating a sense of isolation and inwardness. And, you know, whatever the medium is, whether it's painting, music, they all have ultimately the same result.
I like your language, Joseph, of connective space, because that's what gets severed, and that's where the pain is, because, you know, we're social animals, and to reconnect with ourselves and our species, and Sarah, especially in your case, with the community. You became a community activist.
Yes, and I think, you know, once I had gone through my own personal process, I started to discover that my work that came out of that actually had, you know, it provided other people with something to connect with through their own, you know, difficulties. And that was so surprising to me. It was so surprising to me. And Joe, listening to you talk about both Dante and your own writing, it just makes me want to read your book and read Dante.
That's the goal. but just to build on what you just said, I mean, what I had wanted to write this book, I had wanted to write something about, you know, that the experience of life after death, and also a testament to Dante's wisdom in that time. But I didn't know I would write the book until I'd published a very brief excerpt in the New York Times that put together the story of me dealing with Catherine's death and turning to Dante. And the response was incredible in that it was people who had had terrible losses. I mean, I got some incredibly moving communications by email and letter that, in some cases they were literary people, in some cases they weren't. But I had touched a nerve where people who had gone through something so private, so terrible, suddenly felt less alone and wanted to share their story. And I thought, well, there it is. I have to write this book because this is what it's about, you know? If you can get to that space with whether it's readers or people, you mentioned people looking at your artwork and you being surprised by them, kind of, it opened up something in them. The same thing happened to me in the writing process where that affirmed the need to do this kind of book.
Sarah, tell us a little bit about what you're doing now and how you are.
I'm well, thank you. You know, that was a long time ago, and it feels very distant to me in certain ways. But I'm still involved in healing. And what I think about, and healing through my work, and the way I think about it now is that it's a sacred act to make work. And the hope is, and this is really aspirational in a big way, that it has some lasting capacity to inspire people and heal people when they see it. And believe me, I have no, I have nothing on Dante. I don't even expect to be in that league. But I know when I listen to great music and I see dance and I go to the art museum, I am healed. I do experience that physically and emotionally. And that's what I try to imbue my work with now.
I want to ask you, Joseph, is, you know, about where Catherine is for you now.
Oh, wow. I think that, you know, there's so many different ways to look at this. I would say the reality of Catherine now is what I learned is that we live on in the people we leave behind. You know, whether it's physically in her daughter, Isabel, but even beyond that, what she did to my life, she changed my life. I'm living a certain way now because of what she had given me, the gifts, the, you know, the what it means to be in a fulfilling relationship, a giving relationship, what it means to orient yourself to the world with sympathy and kindness. And those acts, I think Wordsworth calls them those small unremembered acts, mm-hmm. which make up the better part of our nature. I'm paraphrasing, but the energy and the will, the goodwill and the sort of legacy that you leave behind that manifests itself in the way you act in the world, I think is an incredible legacy. And that's why, you know, Catherine's spirit lives on.
What does Isabel know about her mom?
There's a picture of her mom in her room, and, you know, we never have hid anything from Isabel. We thought it was important when she was little that she get acclimated to, you know, a normal life, and that she have as happy as infancy as she could under the circumstances, and that when the time came that we would go into greater depth about this person, that she already is already in her, you know, in her world, and she's close with Catherine's family and that. So I think there'll come a time when, you know, we sit down and we have these deep discussions about who her mom was and the kind of relationship she wants to have to the memory of her mother. And, you know, I know there's a lot of probably books written on the subject of when the right time is. I think my wife and I, our feeling is we'll know intuitively because we have strong lines of communication with Isabel.
Yeah, you don't need books to tell you when the right time is. None of us do, with all due respect to my colleagues. So Isabel does have good contact with her biological mother's parent family?
Her biological grandma on Catherine's side just died, but yeah, you know, they're wonderful people, and they're a part of our lives, absolutely.
How has this experience, Joseph, changed the way you experience your life and your death?
I'll focus on one thing it's a big question, but I would say the big change in my life beyond, you know, rebuilding my personal life and things like that, where when Catherine died in 2007, I'm a professor now, and I was then. My writing at the time had been almost exclusively scholarly, very academic, you know, specialist work. I think after she died, something went off inside me where I said, okay, I still love that scholarly conversation, that specialized conversation, that world of academic writing, but I really feel like there's another kind of writing that I want to do where I can reach regular readers, you know, not just in this isolated world. And that was involved making a jump to trying to write the kind of books like In a Dark Wood and before this, My Two Italies, that really speak to people just about life, but not just books.
You know, go on.
And I think to me, that's been an incredible gift because that's made me so much happier because I feel, like you said earlier, Sarah, that you're reaching people. And, you know, we're not Dante, but you get emails, you get letters, you get communications where you've actually had an impact on someone who's read your book or seen your work. And that is something that is new for me. And it's like finding a new voice, so to speak.
Well, a new voice or your voice. I mean, it's been my experience personally and with many that, you know, when your life becomes shattered, you almost have no choice but to become more of who you are.
Yeah. What a great way to put it, because for me, that's totally the case, because I had wanted to do this kind of writing before. And, you know, like many people, you choose a life track that's, you have a profession, you have responsibilities, and it's not, sometimes you put aside your dreams from a younger time, or, you know, that sense of what you really want to do. And I think when Catherine died, there was a sense of, we all know the cliche, how fragile life is, but then when you live it, it's a whole totally different thing.
Yeah, you know? Way different than a bumper
sticker. It's way different. It's no longer an abstract question. And so I said, okay, it means rolling the dice a little bit and stepping outside my comfort zone and setting myself up for possible failure. But it seemed like a necessary...
Of course. Well, listen, I want to ask you both to listen to something we've prepared for the end of the show. As most of us know by now, we've lost a great thinker and writer over this weekend, and neurologist Oliver Sacks. He was on the show in 2008, and we interviewed him about his book Musicophilia and about his use of music for his own healing. Let's listen.
In the course of psychotherapy sessions, music often comes into my mind, and fortunately my therapist himself is pretty musical, and he's usually able to identify the music and maybe to track things which are going on, which I'm not conscious of, but which the music gives a clue to, because music is so inseparably connected with memory and emotion, and including sort of unconscious memories and emotions, so there's some... a great deal can be revealed this way.
That was neurologist Oliver Sacks, who we lost this weekend. May his memory be for a blessing. As we close the show, a great thanks to Joseph Luzzi, author of In a Dark Wood, and Sarah Steele, award-winning artist here in Philadelphia. Well, it's been a great hour on the healing power of the arts. Let us know if there's a poem, book, music, or artwork that's helped you heal. Listen, Tuesday, September 8th is the 30th anniversary of our show. We're going to be in front of a live audience, and we're going to talk about the past, and we're going to talk about some important changes in our future. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, have a good week, my friends.